The Mixing Music Podcast is proud to say that we have a lot of free resources outside of the actual podcast. Visit mixingmusicpodcast.com/links to find access to our free PDFs and free resources.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me, as always, is... Lou. We're slowly just giving up on the nicknames.
Oh my god.
Pot of Greed Lou.
Oh, that's not even an L.
That's not even any sort of alliteration at all.
I mean, you could say loving you, Lou.
Is it called alliteration when it's like a... I think that's what it is. I'm mistaken, maybe.
I don't know. Maybe we can say my name is Gary and just call me Gary the Giraffe.
Yeah, my co-host, Gary
the Giraffe.
We just go totally different.
It's
totally.
Like, wait, what happened to Lou? Like all the podcast listeners, not YouTube, just podcast listeners are like, wait a minute.
I'm not going to lie.
Gary?
That's my favorite. That's my favorite nickname to date. Just like totally scratch the Lou thing and just who the
Gary
hell is Gary?
Giraffe.
And then just Giraffe. It's like a two G's, but they're not even the same sound.
Gary or, the Gargoyle?
Okay, that's two hard G's. But Gary the Giraffe, that killed me. All right, and today we have a special guest. Thank you for joining us on the show. He is a mixer. He is a vocal production vocal producer. He is a recording engineer all the way from Washington. Sendai Mike.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yee. You're from Washington, right? Not Oregon.
Yeah. Washington, Seattle.
Okay, that's right. Because I don't know what it is. I'm an idiot, and I always... Oregon, Washington, to me, are just interchangeable.
Oh, yeah. I mean... It's everything's so spread out. If you're never up here, it's just, you know, it's just a bunch of trees, basically. It's nice, though.
I would love to go to Washington. Is Washington the state where there's no sales tax?
That's Oregon. That is.
Oh, shit.
I'm not going to lie, but that sounds enticing.
Wait.
That sounds really enticing.
Is keep Oregon weird? Is that Oregon or is that keep Seattle weird?
That's Portland.
That's keep Portland weird. Wait, Portland is Oregon.
Yep.
What the heck? What? Okay, hold on. Washington has the big sky tower, the
Space
Tokyo
Needle.
Tower.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Space Needle.
It's the Space Needle, yes. Not Tokyo Tower.
I don't know where DK's head is today, but it's physically here.
But welcome. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining the podcast and for engaging in our stupid banter.
We don't mean to downplay it, but
but Mike, we love you, and you're a wonderful vocal producer, engineer, and I know you make a lot of content. You've may have heard of Mike from Twitter, TikTok, YouTube. He's posting content all the time. I think you're really grinding TikTok recently.
Oh, I'm trying to just get a couple videos out a week, man. I mean, it's not the everyday thing like it should be, but you know, just getting a couple out a week is where I'm at right now.
But yeah, I think like with content, the grind is just consistency. I feel like making the content itself isn't that hard. It's more about like the ideation of what to talk about and like doing the tedious work of just posting it. It doesn't take that much effort, I feel like.
I feel I think the ideation is the part of the effort that it takes. You know what I mean? Like, because I'll be honest, like I sit in my office, I'm like, I should make a video. There's a million things I can talk about, but I can't think of one.
Right.
I can't think of one. Yeah.
Also, also, if you're listening to the podcast right now and you are wondering what the heck me and Lou look like, or maybe what the heck Sendai Mike looks like, we stream the podcast recordings every Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, or you should subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/YouTube, subscribe to the YouTube channel. One of our most recent reviews on Apple, they left a 5-star review and they said how awesome the podcast is, and then made a comment about how much DK did not look like what I thought DK would look like, but Lou looks exactly like what I thought Lou would look like.
And he said good on that, and I was like,
what does that mean?
Thank you.
Is that a compliment? Like, you look exactly what you sound like.
It's like, I hope it's handsome. I really hope it's handsome. My mom says I'm handsome.
Oh man, this is a good episode already. But today we're very blessed to have Mike join us on the podcast, and we're gonna together, all three of us, we're gonna talk about the whole recording process from contact to sending them the file, completing that, and maybe even like follow-ups and going beyond that. Mike is recording artists every single day. He's got a great booking system and he's quite busy. And Mike, I know that you got some systems going on, and I know that you like, this is at this point, it's kind of like a job for you. It's a gig. It's like it's regular. You don't have to do too much. Yeah, like kind of clock in, clock out, which is a great place to be. I wish everybody was like getting paid clients every day, just clocking in, clocking out. But so, I mean, you've got it figured out. Where does the process start for you for new or maybe even existing clients, wherever you want to start?
I mean, I think it's important, like, I guess, just even like before we jump into the actual, like what it is about the recording, like the thing that I'm doing specifically is vocals over in the box production. And that, I guess that's the market for that is just exploding right now. So that's sort of my niche. And I think the process around that, is fairly specific, and it's suitable for like short hourly sessions. So most of the people that are coming to me, they're booking between 2 to 6 hours to record over pre-made instrumentals, just vocals. And the point I'm trying to get to is like the thing that helps me retain those people for years and years and years isn't necessarily the same things in recording them that if they were like a high level vocal talent with large budget. Like the process for recording that is a very different process than recording an emerging artist on a time constraint, on a low budget. And that's kind of the niche I've found myself in, I guess. Have you guys, I mean, what's it looking like in LA? Like, are you guys recording? It seems like everywhere there's more and more people with just less musical experience coming into studios.
I can't speak. This is interesting. First off, I haven't been in the recording industry for like decades, you know.
Right.
I'm still finishing up my first decade, which is, so I think that there's other people that can speak on that more and more as far as like over the decades and over like several generations. I have noticed that ever since I moved to LA, less people have, and we're talking about musical experience, not recording experience, which is separate.
Right.
There's a lot more people in LA that are trying to be artists that have never done music before than there was in Utah. Like in Utah, nobody's ever been in a recording studio before because it's a small town, but everybody that wanted to come in had a lot of musical experience and beyond just singing, which is a very interesting thing. We do get a lot of clients that get a beat and we're just trying to keep them in pitch and help them find melodies. Exactly.
It's been one of the most interesting things for me for recording like this. It's really like an emerging and ever growing segment of the recording market. Because it used to infuriate me when people would come in and they're like, I want to do 6 songs in this hour. And, we're just one taking them. And, it used to make me so mad, or not mad, but I used to fight that, you know, I used to fight it. But I've just come over the years, you know, to like, I just lean into it. You know, there's everybody's at a different point. You know, some people are just trying to do high volume and, yeah, the process for recording in that situation, it's very different in terms of how we're making decisions and how we're moving between takes. It's entirely different than, you know, another artist who might book the whole day for just tracking their song. And so I found in recording, you know, it's served me from a business perspective, I guess, to just meet the clients exactly where they're at in terms of what they're trying to get done. And I really try not to impose my own methodologies, unless it's going to be helpful and they're receptive to it. But I really try to meet the clients where they're at for their recording styles. Do you guys, like, I guess, you know, I've never spent any time in commercial studios, never worked with other engineers. Do you guys have like pretty, like, when you have a new client come in, like, what does that typically look like for you guys?
Well, it really depends. When you say commercial, like out here in LA, commercial is more defined by a large format studio versus a production studio. Because you can say that there's like three classes of studios in Los Angeles. There's commercial, there's production, and then there's like writing studios. Writing studios typically will just be like a one mic, maybe a booth kind of setup. Production studios will maybe feature a few keyboards, but still kind of like the one mic setup. They're not really set up for like a lot of like bands or anything. And then commercial is more like, okay, you know, we could record full drums, horn sections, whatever you want to do. And in those three different stages, you actually get labels that'll book just about any of them for a well-known writing session, where I've had sessions where, you know, you might walk in with seven different writers. Writing for one artist, and because of that, you've got seven different people's, you know, recording styles to manage, and you're the one engineer. Maybe they bring their own engineer and they hop in the seat, maybe. But a good example of this is when I was recording Keisha Cole's album back in 2021, we had Brandy, Nelly, Ray J, Kay Forrest, Tristan, and a bunch of other people like pull in writing for Keisha's album, kind of coming up with concepts, but all of them work very differently from each other. So it was a matter of being adaptable to your clients. It's so similar to your situation where it's meeting your client where they're at. It's very much the same here, except that you don't know if it's going to be, sometimes when you're working on a commercial level, you don't know if you're working with just that artist, but typically not. There's usually a posse of writers or producers that are involved in the process. Then you have to be able to match or, you know, excel past their expectations of their own process. If you can't match it, a lot of times they'll, next time you see them, they'll probably bring their own person.
Yeah. In those situations when there's multiple writers, like, are they asking for your feedback at all? Or is it?
Sometimes it depends on your relationship for sure.
Gotcha. Most of the time, default, no. Default, absolutely not.
Default, exactly.
Like, you can get kicked out.
Totally.
Yes, but once again, it goes back to the relationship. If you're the new guy in the room, taking on a new client, for sure, they might ask you if they're cool, you know, like, not saying, they're not cool if they don't ask you, but, like, if they're cool people, typically speaking, they might try to interact with you and build a relationship with you, too, and part of that may be, like, asking for your opinion and seeing how you respond to things.
So, this is interesting. Let's separate the conversation like this, because I do think, like, having, like, a commercial label-funded recording vocal production session is different, and the expectations are very different from, like, home studio, like, grinding every single day. Not even home studio, but, like, more personal relationships. Like, for example, most of my clients are still not label sessions. They're mostly independent artists. So, we'll talk about, like, independent artists versus label artists, which is a totally different thing when you have like the producer and the songwriter in the room versus like what I'm doing from what I understand you're doing and what I've always been doing. And what most people in the industry, freelancers, are doing is with independent artists. Let's start with that expectation there. Where for you, Mike, what is kind of, how does it start? So they book a session on your website or through an app, or like how do you have it set up?
It's on the website and it's entirely open. So anybody can book at any time. They don't need to know me. They don't need to contact me prior. And it's just first come, first serve for open sessions, basically. And so I get...
And how many hours a week do you dedicate to being open?
About 30 hours a week of sessions. That's about the max. That's about the max that I feel comfortable doing and giving everybody like a high level of service without, you know, too much ear fatigue and all that.
I assume you do other work outside of those 30 hours, but those 30 hours are specifically for with client recordings.
Yep.
How much time do you spend in total working, and what's your other hours spent on typically?
It's gone down a lot over the years. I come in probably between 40 and 50 hours a week now. And on the other days I'm making content, I'm doing mixes for people, I'm doing revisions for people. And just admin stuff, you know. It's just a one man operation over here. And, you know, I outsource a little bit, but a lot of the admin stuff I'm still just handling on my end.
Perfect. That's actually really great insight. All right. So let's say they book a session with you. You go get them from the parking lot, walk them up. What's it look like for you?
Oh man. Well, if I know them, you know, and most of the people I'm working with, I've been working with for, you know, a long time at this point. So typically most people that are coming in, I've been working with them for a lot of times, years. And so we just get right into it. It's like, they're going straight in the booth. I'm loading the beats and we're recording. Like I'm just doing sessions back to back to back. So it's the timing is tight enough that, it's straight to work basically. If I don't know them and it's their first session, it's basically the same. And I just, you know, I ask what we're getting into on the way up. And, but I'm in a situation where most people know what I do and they're booking me for this very specific thing. You know, they want to come in and they're recording a number of songs in a short period of time.
So this is great. We talk about this often on the podcast. One, what percentage of your clients is returning versus new? Like every week on average?
Every week, I would say it's probably, right now, you know, if I do 12 sessions a week on average, one or two of them might be brand new and the rest I've been working with for quite a while.
So nice. It's interesting. So for us, we've talked about this with clients versus customers and whatnot. But it's fair to say it's returning clients, not first time clients. It's returning clients that make you the most amount of money.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. And on top of that, you become more efficient. You're able to better serve them and whatnot. What are some ways that you find that's really important in order for customers to return?
Right. So this is something that I've been thinking a fair amount about, because it's like making the song sound as good as possible in what I think sounds good is not always the thing that is going to retain these folks as clients. So typically, like I'm thinking about three things usually. Like the person, for them to return, you know, ideally they're going to believe that I really like their music, or at least respect them as artists. That's a very important thing.
They want someone to be on their team.
Exactly.
They don't necessarily. That's so interesting. Your point number one is not about whether or not you have the right plugins or the right equipment. Point number one is, am I able to get excited about their music, and can they see that excitement? That's crazy. Yep. That's awesome. I love that.
I think, and they also have to, in terms of client retention, they have to feel like they're getting, they have to feel like they can afford to come back, you know? So wherever you lie in the scale and efficiency in the market, they have to feel like you're a good choice. Cause you know, it doesn't matter how much they like you or how great the mix sounds, if they can't afford to come back to you the next week. And so that's a thing that I don't expect everybody to, you know, obviously charge as much as you can for your services, but, you know, there's a point here and where they have to feel like, I feel like I like to make people feel like they're getting a good value for what they're paying. And then the third thing obviously is they have to like how it sounds, you know. If they don't like how it sounds, then none of the other stuff matters.
Of course.
And it's how they have to like how it sounds, not even me, you know, because I find, especially in hip hop now, I ask people for references and they give me the worst sounding music I have ever heard in my life. So it's really bizarre. But as long as they like the way it sounds, and I'm always asking, even if I think it sounds good, I'm always asking for that feedback of how do you feel about this effect? How do you feel about that? And some people just trust me to do it. But even when I think it's good, I like to get their approval so that they can feel like they have agency and control in the situation. And I'm shocked a lot of times at the decisions people make, but I'm happy to oblige.
So I think that list, those 3 points are extremely important, and I think they're very true. I'm sure that we both have experiences with this. Lou, I want to ask you, and I want to rewind and go back to the point that you made about returning clients versus new clients. Mm-hmm. I wonder if people in the audience or people listening to the podcast or subscribe to the YouTube channel have ever thought that the secret to going full-time in music is increasing the volume of new customers. It's not. I want to be very, very clear that how you go full-time in music is by creating a large pool of returning clients. I'm not talking about like 10 clients that come back every single week. They can come back once every year or two. But if they only come back once a year, you got to have a very, very large pool. And so it's when I had every single client was returning, but when they last came was varied. So maybe they came a week ago, maybe they came a month ago, maybe they came 2 years ago. Like every single client is a returning client, but I've mm-hmm. seen them before and won them over in whatever capacity. So I think that's the secret to going full time. And like you said, number one is like believing in their product. Artists and producers and people want, like, this is a very, it's an art form. Like, music is an art form. It's very subjective. And, you know, like, I want to go to a creative director that believes in my vision. And I'm willing to pay more for a creative director that believes in my vision, right? It's less about, can you execute my idea? But can you see the same idea that I have?
Yep.
And then we could execute together. Because either way, I, as the person coming to you, would still want to be a major part of that project. Like, I may not know what the heck you're doing, Mike, but like, if I was an artist, I still want to feel like I'm a major part of that. And I can't feel that way if you don't believe in me. So that's number one. Then what was the number two point that you made?
It's just the budget thing. And that's specifically for the clientele that I'm working with. You know, like, people don't have huge budgets and they have limited time frames. And so,
Let's expand on that. I think this is important. When people, we've done a couple episodes about pricing. You can go back to those episodes and how you should price your own products and whatnot. But this is super important. People always DM me and Lou, and I assume people ask you all the time, like, well, how do you price your services that are viable in the marketplace? Number one, the most important part is you have to compare to everybody else in your local area. If you are a recording producer, whatever, it is a locational-based services. You're not an online, book me on Fiverr. You're competing against other people in the location. So if next-door neighbor Lou is charging $20 an hour and he has twice as much gear as I do and a bigger space than I do and 10 years more experience than I do, why the heck should I be charging $20 an hour? Obviously, those numbers are super low. But I mean, what I'm saying?
I was about to say, like, if I had all that gear, I don't think I could afford it at $20 an hour.
Just an example. So you got to actually, like, compare. And number two point I want to make about this is sometimes you lose clients because they can't afford you. Like, this was a one-time thing. They wanted to do something special for themselves by paying a little bit extra for a nicer engineer. But you know that they can't afford you, or they know that they can't afford you again the next time. Do you ever get hung up? Is it worth hung up on losing clients over that?
I've kind of in the beginning, it was a lot harder for me. But what I've done, and I've done this every single year now for 5 years, is on the first of the year, I raised my rates $10 an hour. And, you know, I realized I started at like $20 or $30 an hour. So every year on the first, raise them $10 an hour. And a month before that, I let everybody know. And in the first few years, I let everybody buy unlimited gift cards at the old rate that they can use anytime in the future. And then over the last 3 years, what I've done is if you have met a certain threshold of volume for bookings, I let you continue booking at last year's rate. So basically, a large percentage of the people I'm working with are grandfathered in, and there's multiple levels of that going on. So it makes that's really been good because it's allowed me to retain a lot of people, but you know, everybody booking for the first time pays the new rate, and over time, you know, the percentage of people paying the newest rate, you know, it expands in terms of the percentage of paying clients.
Question for you: when you increase your prices every single year, are you already booked at full capacity, like throughout the year, or do you raise it regardless of how often people booked you during the year?
I mean, because I only put 30 hours a week in the calendar, I basically work those full 30 hours every single week year round. You know, occasionally I'll have somebody cancel like the day before, or there'll be a slow spot at the end of the month where I'll have a session or two open.
So when you raise your prices, that you're partially, because what I don't want anybody in the audience, anybody listening, to do is raise their prices every year, even though they're already booking no clients.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. The demand has stayed exactly even for me. And this is just specific to my situation. I've been able to do this, and the demand either it stays even or goes up every time I do it, weirdly.
So if you don't mind me asking, have you ever walked back a price?
For hourly recording?
Just in general, you saw an increase that was suitable, let's say it be mixing, right? Something that's not solely based on your hourly. But did you ever find a situation where you had to walk back your price?
Oh, in general, in terms of like the quotes that I'm
mixing? Yeah. Maybe not like immediately after a quote, but like you started noticing like, hey, there's been a little more of a dip than I expected. Let me retract this increase.
I have done that in my mixing a little bit, remote mixing, but I'm in a situation here where because of the hourly recording, I'm not relying on the mixing, the remote mixing work, you know, to keep the bills paid. And because of that, there's been times, yes, but to answer your question, yes, there has been times earlier in my career when I was doing very cheap mixes, and I tried to raise my prices aggressively, and it didn't, you know, the volume just really dropped off. But now, because I don't rely on the mixing work, I haven't really had to dial things back.
So I want to recap because you dropped some heavy gems, some great ideas. One, gift cards at the end of the year, and people can buy unlimited at the old price, because usually at the end of the year, especially during the holidays, there's a decrease in bookings. So it's like slower season for the audio recording industry, typically, maybe not for you, but typically, right? So it's a great idea to boost that income at the end of the year and hopefully carry that over, help you over during the slow speed. And it's only $10 an hour, so you're not losing that much when you get into it. Second thing, I freaking love the ideas. If you hit a certain threshold of bookings, they get grandfathered into a price. That is a genius idea.
And I'm really not trying to punish anybody. You know, that's a, you know, I don't want to punish these people that have really put me on. Like, I get to do this because they booked so much.
That's amazing.
So the question is, where is that threshold?
Yeah. How have you discovered? What do you do it?
Oh man. I basically just looked for a certain number of sessions in the past calendar year. And, there are actually though, there's exceptions that I've made in both directions. That it's just on personal discernment, I guess, man. It's not there are people that, you know, if they like, I guess basically there's a certain volume in the last calendar year. And that's what I did. That's what I did last year. The year before that, it was, this was the first year that I did it with any sort of systematic way. The years before that, it was just personally selective of the people that I had booked a lot and I liked working with.
Okay. And how have you discovered, was it good? I mean, it worked well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, people love it, man. People come back, you know, it's weird to talk about it publicly because I always ask people don't talk about the coupon codes. But I know the audience.
I've given people heavy discounts and then say like, don't tell anybody I'm giving you discounts.
Right. So there's a number of people who have these codes, and I just ask them not to share the code with other people. And if they do, you know, I'll know who shared it, you know? So everybody's happy. I think, and it makes I think it also helps make the artist feel like, you know, we're in cahoots, you know, we're working together on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like the whole cycle of, hey, I'm actually rooting for you. And then they're like, oh, they're rooting for me. I got to go with him more. So it kind of strengthens the relationship even more. That's a very strategic way of doing that. Last thing that I want to talk about, another gem that you dropped that I want to emphasize again is you give everybody notice of prices going up at least a month before, which is great. Yeah. Which is great. If you do not inform people or announce that changes are going to be made, I would call that emotional theft, like borderline theft. Like, you don't want to be doing that. It's only going to hurt your brand and hurt the integrity of your brand. So anybody that's wanting to increase their prices, you have to give as much warning or as much, hey, this is going to change. I mean, all these other companies do it as well. PlayStation, when they charge for their network, or like Amazon, when different prices increase and stuff. Like, yeah, it's true. You should be doing that. People are okay with things as long as they're notified. Hey, this project is going to take a week longer than I thought. So please expect a mix a week later. As long as they know what part of the process that you're in and you notify them, people usually don't mind waiting or don't mind bad news. The last thing that I want to talk about, this is an economics term. You talked about this, where we're figuring out what's in economics is called elasticity. I've talked about elasticity in the past. Elasticity is basically how much more you can increase the price and maintain the amount of customers. So it's more of like a ratio. For example, if you have a high elasticity business, for example, like Disney, let's say the tickets are $50 per ticket, they double their tickets. And so it's $100, and they went and they lost half their clients. They're still making more money because now there's less people in the park, so the lines are shorter, more happy customer service, less people that need janitor service, and less people watching the lines. So Disney is making more money, right? Because of that. But the thing is, like, this ratio, this elasticity can be like, if there's a formula to discover what the elasticity is of a company like Nike or Disney, but it's hard to figure out what it is for us, because we find out if we have very bad elasticity, very low elasticity, we increase our prices $5, we lose half of our clients. And obviously hurts us. Yeah. But you've given so much value and have so many returning clients and genuinely so busy and offer so few amount of spots and limited amount of time that you have a very high level of elasticity. You can increase your prices every single year and your demand doesn't change.
Granted, though, I have to, you know, add the caveat that I started at a very, very low rate. So that's the other, you know, I'm still cheaper than most other studios.
So question. Yeah. So you started like $20, $30 an hour. I assume you're closer to like 50, 60 right now?
I'm a 70.
You're a 70. Okay, dope. Let me ask you, when you first started, would you recommend other people that are in similar positions to you 5 years ago, would you recommend that they start at a low price? Or would you recommend that they start at whatever?
I would recommend starting at whatever the market gives you. So if you come in at a certain price and people, you know, you got to price yourself at what's going to give you the volume to get the experience, to get to the referrals, to get more clients. And if that means going low at first, go low and then raise them as fast as you can while retaining as many people as you can. But I guess that would be my answer. It entirely depends on just what the local market is kind of telling you.
When you were booking at $20 an hour, $20, $30 an hour, I assume you were lesser known, you were a brand new business. Was the price alone enough to get you fully booked, or were you still had hours that were not filled?
It was a little bit different then, because when I first started, you know, when I first started at like 20 an hour, I was in my bedroom recording after work. So I was doing like one session a night, basically. And then when I moved into the space, I was made myself available 24 hours a day. So there were days that I didn't work. And then there were days that I worked 14 hours, just depending on, you know, like it just depend on the, so it wasn't until, And I don't have good records, honestly, man. But I feel like the weekly volume since I went full time has stayed pretty even, if not gone down, because I shrank my available hours. You know, I started reducing the number of hours that I was available as time went on.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this, because I noticed you mentioned that you use coupons. There's something that I've done in the past. I don't know if you've done this as well. I don't know if DK's done this as well. But one suggestion that I've told people in the past is, a lot of times if you walk in and somebody introduces you as the intern, whoever they introduce you to now has a pretty long-term hold that you're an intern. I feel like part of that is also your pricing, but I don't believe that your static price necessarily is what you walk in offering a new client all the time. I'm a big fan of discounting on the way in, but making it very aware, like, this is because you're a new client and I'd like an opportunity to show you what I can do for you. Let me lower the cost on the first time service for you. What I've done recently is I'll give individual artists a timed coupon code where it's specifically to their name. It's only for them. Their coupon code is usually their name. And it'll last maybe 2 weeks, and say, hey, like, if you want to take up the offer, like, I can hold this offer for you for like 2 weeks. You can go directly to my website. It'll give you X amount off. This is only for you. And if relationships work out and they have a specific budget, I'll give them their associated budget worth on a code that they can use for a limited amount of time before the price has to go back to normal. I don't know if you've ever done anything like that. I noticed, like, you mentioned you have coupons for Select. I don't know how you handle, you know, making sure whoever's paying what price can do that by booking you easily online. I don't know if you track that through, like, services online, or do you manually track that yourself?
Like, who's booking at what rate?
Exactly. Like, do you use, like, any portals for that, or?
No, not really. I mean, I all the booking I do is through Acuity, and so it's all just built into there. Honestly, it would be good to look at that information, though.
I do it in Acuity.
Acuity is great.
Yeah.
Acuity scheduling is what we use for the studio as well.
Yeah, you can create like unlimited coupon codes. So I do that for clients who have also grandfathered in. Like, I have one client who, whenever she books with me, I actually don't pay myself. I pay the studio for the time, and I don't pay myself the 8 hours that I work with her, just because I've been working with her so long that she's just an artist that I enjoy viewing how she's been growing, you know? But she's the only one that has that. So I created like a backdoor code for it.
I've got a similar situation with a couple guys, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to move on, but I do want to say something that you just said. We're going to come back around to it.
Sure.
You said that you pay the studio, but you don't pay yourself. What does that mean? We're going to talk about that a little bit later, and how that works for us, because that's a very us specific thing. It might be more commercial as well. We're going to move on and come back to that idea and why that was said. Mike, let's go into the next phase. So let's say the recording goes well. You send them the file. Everything's paid. Or what is there anything specific that you like to do or offer during the session?
You know, that's something I've been thinking about, of adding, you know, adding some more amenities to the studio. But I don't, you know, it's really just strictly business. We're just recording and mixing and a lot of times as fast as we can, for better or for worse.
Would you say that you're pretty quick?
In the realm of work that I'm doing, of like rap and over two tracks. Yeah. But you know, a full mix is going to take me a while to do on a full stem thing.
So when you're preparing a rough mix for a client, are you mixing while you're recording, or do you take like 5 to 10 minutes or however long afterwards during the scheduled time to kind of do as much as you can?
No, I'm basically, you know, I let people know that the quality of the mix that you go home with, it's like, you're going to get a mix and master for every song you record today. And the quality of that mix and master is going to be determined by the amount of time you leave me with it. So if they're just recording as fast as they can, you know, it basically just, you know, I have a vocal chain usually set up from another time they've recorded. I'm just doing a quick check to make sure it's hitting the compressors at the right level. If they have been working with them for long enough, I kind of know the style of effects they like, and it's already set up in their template. And then I'm just watching, watching the meters on the master and making sure the dynamics on the instrumental are good going into the mix bus and the limiters. And then I print it. And I'll do that in however much time they give me, basically, you know, whether it's 5 minutes or, you know, hours.
Quick question. This is more personal. Having done this full time for a while now, and it sounds like you've got like a system going where it's pretty like everything's kind of figured out. Now it's just kind of working through it. Do you ever get bored of it or get complacent with it, or like, how does this fit with your personality?
I like it, man. I mean, I'm not really a people person. So honestly, I would like to just spend less time face to face with artists, and not because I don't like artists, but just because, you know, it's intense personalities and, you know, wears me out. But, no, I love it, man. Never a dull moment. And the thing that I've come to really like, you know, I think the things that used to really frustrate me, I have, you know, like people that are trying to record a lot of songs in 1 hour, or the opposite, you know, people that are so meticulous and they just, you know, they're listening for something that I can't even hear and just doing it over and over and over again. And everyone in between, every single one of those situations is an opportunity for me to meet their needs, whatever crazy needs they might have. And so that's where I find, you know, I still get a lot of, personal gratification, even with the people that I might used to have thought is more mundane or boring or you know, hard to work with, if that makes sense.
Would you consider or think that your career path was pretty typical of others, or do you think that there were a few aspects that were very atypical?
You know, it's hard to say because my career path is, I think it's becoming much more typical. You know, basically like hip hop producer gets to know rappers through making beats, realizes they can make more money from recording and mixing, start recording and mixing. I feel like that's becoming more and more typical, just based on the current climate. And it seems like now when I look around Seattle, there's more and more like little studios like mine that are just doing vocals over two tracks. It seems like every week there's a new studio opening. So it's really, I think, becoming more and more common that style, but it hasn't always been like that.
This is a question from the live stream chat right now from Straight Trippin'. What helped your transition from bedroom to your own space? What was that like? I assume you already had some clients who were making some money. Did you quit your job? I mean, it sounds like you did because you went full 24 hours.
So I was, formerly a civil engineer. And so I was working in a cubicle doing that.
You were making decent money.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't getting rich, but you know, all my bills were paid.
Well, rich to who? Like a 20-year-old?
right. You know, I have a 4-year degree to do this work. Anyways though, the transition was like, it was a small team in the office. So I let my boss know that I would like to leave. I will continue working on this project that I was currently working on. And once that project is wrapped up, I'm going to leave. The project dragged out for almost an entire year. So I had that entire year to basically be recording people in my room at night. And during that time I was thinking like, oh, maybe I'll go into live audio. Maybe I'll go into, you know, like there was, I was like, I didn't know exactly what it was going to look like during that time. I thought maybe I'd go into live sound or video game audio, or I didn't even know, you know, but I just kept recording and mixing people. And then the year came up, the project almost finished, and I was like, I'm done. It's been a year. I rented this unit and I moved out of my house and I moved into this unit. So, I worked and lived in here and just grinded it out for about 2 years until I was making enough money to comfortably like afford rent and the studio space. And that's sort of the trajectory. I could have moved out way sooner, but, just ultra conservative, you know, from the financial side.
I can cut this out if this is private information, but just to kind of put a little perspective, how much was your salary at your civil engineering job?
I think I was making around, like when I first started, it was probably around 50. And when I left, it was probably 60 and change.
Okay. So, and how old were you at the time? Fresh out of college?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're like early 20s, making 50 to 60 yeah. grand a year. That's a decent chunk of money for
in
like a
Seattle.
Young. And which is the reason why I bring this up is because you went and jumped, shipped, and went full time or tried to go full time into audio. Your first year, do you remember how much you made your first year doing audio only?
Like probably like 20 grand or something like that.
So you like cut all less, more than half of your income was cut.
Yeah.
That like, I cannot imagine how terrifying that is. Cause my experience, I think yours is similar. I've always been poor, you know, so there was no jump down to lesser income. I've just never had any income. but for you, I know a lot of people that was the barrier. It's just so fucking scary yeah. to pursue passion. Like, cause you got what we say, like the golden handcuffs. What was it for you? Were you just so sick and tired of the job or what was it?
Incredibly depressed, just really miserable. And so it was almost, it's so weird to say this, man, but in terms of transitioning, it was a fear and really just negative emotions that drove me to, it wasn't like my passion for mixing SoundCloud rappers that drove me to open the studio. It was just a fear and deep, deep, just dislike for putting on the collared shirt every day and going to that office. And the work was good. The work was good, man. Just didn't suit me, man. I went to school for 5 years and worked in the industry for 4 years. And because I, you know, that was the path I was on, but did not suit me.
I wonder, I think there's a beauty to all of this. Lou, I'm wondering if you can speak of this too, but did you have to jump or were you in the same situation that I was? Like you built your career from the beginning.
I did a 2/3 financial cut similar to Sundar.
Okay, so you had a non-music job.
I worked until I no longer found it emotionally feasible.
But
anymore.
It was still, was this, are you talking about like Ash?
No. The last job I had before like going full-time into audio was Recording Connection. I had just written like the curriculum and got
so paid, it was still like audio based, but it
yeah,
wasn't.
But it was like, you know, I was a liaison for the company, getting studios to partner with the company.
So that's a different story on its own. But you also had a jump.
Yeah, like at the time I was making maybe just like Sendai, I was recording people after work and maybe getting paid on some of them sometimes, but I had to give up 2/3 of my income in order to go full time.
2/3 of your income. That sounds very similar. That's crazy. I wonder if this has any sort of one of the benefits. We may have talked about this on a previous episode of why you and we did an entire episode dedicated to why you may want to keep your day job while starting your audio career. And one of the arguments that I made was the gratitude. For example, for you, it was the depression. It's like, I'm going to kill myself anyway, so might as well doing it what I love. You know, it's like, it wasn't, that jump may not have been that scary because you just, depression made you do it. But, so I don't mean to tease you on that, but.
No, it's real though.
there's, and with that, I think that you have a very deep, you both have a very deep sense of gratitude. Because even now, 5-6 years later, I assume there's a part of you that's fucking grateful that you don't have to be a civil engineer yet anymore.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, speak on that.
Just going back, you know, asking me if it ever gets boring, you know, just to circle back to that again. It's like even the worst, and I mean that with love, the worst clients, you know, the most difficult people, I would still rather make music with them than sit in the cubicle with the spreadsheets. So it's, you know, everything's in, it's all in perspective, you know? So that's the great perspectivizer for me. And if I didn't come from civil engineering, I don't think I would have, been able to do this, you know, if I hadn't come from something that I dislike so strongly.
Let me ask you, would you say that that is the catalyst for your continuance in this? Or have you found something else along the way that's actually helped fuel your want to continue down the line? Because some people, you know, they do this, they find their niche or they find their flow, but then it goes back to, it's just work.
They find something
point,
more. You know? At first it was, I hate this, but now is it more?
Yeah. It's honestly like, I mean, I've grown. It's like, it's becoming more enjoyable, if anything, like even the difficult people, like as I get better at working with them, you know, there's everybody, everybody, when they're coming to the studio, you get to see them at their best. Like usually, you know, this is like a luxury service for them. You know, they're in a good mood. They're coming to make their music and they're happy. And if I can help them do that, like it's a big, for a lot of people, you know, they feel really good about coming to the studio and it pumps them up. And so like, I just get to feed off that energy. You know, I don't have to worry about marketing the music. I don't have to worry about the vulnerability of putting my art into the world. I just get to help people finish their songs. It's like the best, you know, and so I just get to feed off that, man. And that's really what keeps it interesting and fresh for me, because, that never gets old for me, is just, you know, just, it's fun to finish music, man. It's fun. It's fun to hear it back.
And I wonder, and there's no statistic with this, right? And there's no real way to tell. But I assume it is this deep-rooted, foundational sense of gratitude that you get to do what you do. That really reflects how you are perceived by your clientele. Again, going back to your number one point of why people want to come back, which is, do I feel like my engineer believes in my art?
Yeah.
And if you coming into work every single day, really grateful that you're there in their life during, you're right, a sacred part of their day, you know? And that's so, it's like this cycle is, this is a great, great attitude. Let me ask you, and this is my thing recently, this is in my journey of life, I'm at a point right now where I feel like I know gratitude is the answer. I know it is, right? But I have a hard time finding, like, actually feeling grateful. Like, in a non-active way. Like, I can force myself to be grateful. But how can I passively feel, subconsciously, like, actual gratitude? Some practical practices. Practical. and interesting.
I'm not going to lie, but that's, I don't think we've ever talked about it, but that's actually exactly how I think as well. In the sense that, like you said, it's hard to be passively grateful, even knowing that you have a situation in front of you that most people would die for. You know, most people have a job right now that they hate, that wish they could be doing what we're doing. Part of it is semi going back to what we said earlier about my one client that I don't pay myself for. That's why I asked about the catalyst. Part of it is trying to find something more than just what the job is or what it is that we seek to be, but rather who we can serve in the process. If I could see growth from those that believe in me the way that, and I can find a way to believe in them as much, or show a sense of gratitude towards them by doing something that can help them, then that's honestly more than payment enough for me, because at the very least, I don't feel like I'm taking this opportunity for granted or being ungrateful, but rather now using my resources to, like, you know, I give free office hours and I tell everybody, like, ask me any questions. I'm happy to teach for free. I have paid lessons for like dedicated time, but the more I can help somebody, the less shitty I feel about not being passively grateful anymore, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's
great. It's my way of actively taking on that.
Mike, I'm sure that you've had a couple sessions that you're just not in the right zone.
Oh, yeah.
Not in the right headspace. And these are scary, because if you do that one time, you may lose the client, which is not even your worst fear. Probably the worst fear should be you lose the client and they don't like you so much that they put negative reviews everywhere. They talk shit about you and you lose more potential clients, right?
Yeah.
Beyond just one person. Which is scary. And if possible, you never want to be in a bad headspace when you start working. You always want to do that. But are there any sort of like rituals or traditions or things that help you get into the right headspace? Or how do you kind of maintain that every day?
Certainly not smoking weed in the mornings definitely helps. I mean, I'm a guy that smoked a decent amount of pot over my adult life. And that's something that I figured out in the first few years is like, if I want to run the business and show up at a high level, is I have to be pretty fucking sober and pretty, pretty sharp. And obviously that's probably not a problem for a lot of people. But that's something that's, definitely been good for me. The things that I keep in mind, like little things, is just making sure that while I'm sitting there, if the client's in the booth, out of the booth, with me in the room, is that I try to keep physically moving with the music. And that's a huge indicator, you know, for the client if they just see you just like sitting there, like not moving at all, just clicking, it's a very different vibe. So even when I'm in like if I'm distracted or whatever, I try to keep moving with the music because the clients just intrinsically interpret that as being into it and being engaged. And I've had people even say, oh, like they think that I like this part of the song more than this part of something because I'm, you know, like they're watching, you know, they're watching for your reaction to their music. And so that's like one little thing that I try to do. And it just helps me keep, you know, embodied in the work rather than like getting lost in my own, you know,
That's a really great way to do that. Yeah, no, that's totally true. Like with clients, they totally see you do that. And again, like it's so fun. Even the hardest of hard clients, they're still fucking insecure. They want that validation. That's like a human thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
And if they don't seek it at all, they're crazy. And so, no, I think that's a really great practical thing to take away if you're listening right now. Real quick, before we kind of go on to the next part of the show and kind of wrap this up, I want to thank our sponsor, the Mixing Music Podcast.
Oh, shit.
If you're interested in hearing three times the amount of episodes, so instead of one more episode, instead of one episode a week, every single week, you want three episodes every single week, all you have to do is go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. And that'll get you two extra. You sign up for the exclusive episodes, you get two extra episodes a week, and they're all specifically technical tips. So we take clips from other engineers, other producers, and talk about when their tips that they've shared, and we expand on that. It's been really, really helpful. We have a bunch of subscribers already. Anybody that is subscribed to the, whenever we do giveaways, we have like special discounts and special things for anybody that is involved in that community. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive if you're interested in that. It's $4 a month or $40 a year. It's less than a cup of coffee every day, every month, once a month. So, so thank you for anybody that has already subscribed. But we want to move back into this real quick. Mike, this has actually been extremely insightful of not just how you've grow in your career, but as well as how others can take away from your career and grow that themselves. Is there any major mistake that you've made during your career that you'd hope others would avoid?
Major mistakes. I mean, there's plenty of small mistakes. I'm trying to think of any.
Biggest mistake. Maybe it's not major, but the biggest mistake that you're willing to share.
I think, fighting this is kind of a general, but I think trying to fight what's going on, you know, is in the, and I know that sounds really vague, but in a session, you know, trying to fight the flow that's happening, that is going to be the thing that exhausts you and burns you out. You know, if you have people that are difficult to work with and you're trying to corral them or in one way or the other, if you don't do that in a way that's serving them and you're doing it for the convenience of your own work, it's going to burn you out. And that's something that I definitely experienced in working with people. I don't know if that's clear, but you got to work in a way that's going to serve both you and the artist, you know, in a way that doesn't burn you out. And if you, I think that happens to a lot of engineers, is they're fighting the flow of the session to serve their needs. And it's a quick path to burning out.
Lastly, the last question I want to ask before we end the episode is, do you foresee yourself continuing to record for 30 hours every week, or do you foresee yourself in the future, sometime in the future, transitioning over to mixing completely or doing something else or doing more hours, whatever it is? How do you see yourself transitioning and expanding, scaling over the years?
I mean, I've been talking about this for years, man, but it's I really got to get somebody else working in here, because I don't want to work any more than I already am in terms of face-to-face hours with clients. I'd like to work a lot less face-to-face hours with clients so that I can be better for the fewer people, basically, and have other people working in here and giving them a similar system. You know, that's ultimately my goal, is to give... I have this system that works a specific way for a specific type of client. And I want to be able to give that system to others to work here and to just ultimately have the business serve way more people, and without me personally having to be face to face with so many people.
So you foresee yourself not necessarily moving into a different form of the art, like mixing or mastering, but you see yourself scaling by training others and having it become a lot more passive. So you can then the time and able to.
I still want to mix. I enjoy mixing. I enjoy mastering. But I don't want to do either of those like all day. I don't want to do anything all day, every day, you know? So that's kind of where I see things going.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I think this was actually a really, really great episode, a super insightful episode for anybody listening. It was for me, and it's kind of triggered my brain and how we can incorporate some of the things that you were talking about for our studio. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Mike. Where can people find you?
Oh, sendimike.mixing on Instagram, sendimike on TikTok, sendimike, you know, on the internet.
SENDAI Mike.
And they call you Senpai Mike.
Yeah, dude, you know, you're not the first. I get that every now and then. Yep.
Senpai Mike. I'm
at least happy that it puts a smile on your face. It hasn't gotten to the point where he's like, ugh.
Thank you so much for joining us. Please hit up Sendai Mike if you're interested in pursuing a recording career and would love some advice. Once again, that's at sendaimike.mixing on Instagram. Sendai Mike, just type in Sendai Mike, you'll find him. Really, really great dude. He's more than happy to answer your questions. Thank you so much for joining us. Anything else that you want to say? Any last advice for anybody that's listening?
Not particularly, man.
What about a favorite joke?
On that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy. Are you trying to find the perfect distribution platform to get your music on Spotify and Apple? I personally use and love DistroKid. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/DistroKid to get a small discount and get access to a platform with unlimited uploads for a yearly fee. Happy uploading and enjoy the show.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.